Please excuse our tardiness. We welcome you all this Sunday evening to Challenge 73. We are very pleased to have as our guest Mr. Jonathan Kozel and Miss Amy Cohen. Mr. Kozel is probably best known for his book, Death at an Early Age, which is now in its 15th printing, has been published in 5 languages, and has sold over 1 million copies in the United States. He has recently published a new book entitled Free Schools, which is also a very successful writing. Neil Postman said of Free Schools, "Of all the handbooks for change I know, Free Schools is far and away the best." Nat Hentoff said of it, "Just plain essential." Mr. Kozel, a Harvard graduate and Rhodes Scholar, has lived for many years in Black and Puerto Rican neighborhoods of Boston. His work has appeared in several major publications, among them Life, Look, Saturday Review, Atlantic Monthly, New York Times, Ramparts, and the New Republic. I would like to announce at this time that immediately following Mr. Kozel's speech, there will be a brief reception in the Magnolia Foyer of Rinalda Hall, and Ms. Cohen's folk concert will begin at 10 p.m. Her songs include those she has written herself, songs both she and Jonathan have written, and a number of other folk songs as well. Mr. Kozel and Ms. Cohen will be glad to answer any questions after the folk concert. The title for tonight's lecture appears in the program as What Can a Liberal Education Mean? It will be altered only slightly as Mr. Kozel is speaking on Ethics and Education in a Decade of Ordeal. A warm welcome is extended to Mr. Kozel and Ms. Cohen. Thank you.
It's very intimidating setup here. I'm really glad to be here. Have you ever flown on Piedmont Airlines? You haven't? Well, if you think that's bad, someday you have to try Allegheny, an art part of the country. I'm in the odd position of having started out my teaching career being punished for my views within the Boston Public Schools, so that those of you who are teachers have reason to rethink my strategies. I got bounced 10 days before the end of the school year in 1965. The reason I got fired was because I'd read to a class of almost all Black children a poem by a Black poet, Langston Hughes. And I don't know how it is in Winston-Salem. I have the feeling it's probably different from the rest of the United States, but in Boston, they've got these lists, curriculum lists, and Langston Hughes wasn't on the list. And then I also read, I made another mistake, which was that I read a poem by Robert Frost. And to you, that might not seem so bad, but I picked the wrong poem. Lists were very important, and I read this poem. It's called Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Do you know that poem? Did you? Good. Well, this might mean something to you then, because don't ever sing it in the fourth grade, because it's a sixth grade poem. That's what I was told. And anyway, I was fire, and it's not a very radical poem, is it? It's a very white poem, you know? It's as snowy as it could be, but I was fired because it wasn't on the list. So And so they fired me for what they called curriculum deviation. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? And yet the country is so willing to co-opt us. Within a week, I was offered a job by the OEO for curriculum development, which I am happy to say I didn't take. The Boston School Committee had its own special ways. You know what Mark Twain said about school committees? I suppose you do know that. He said in the beginning, God created idiots. That was for practice. And then he created school committees. Again, I'm sure Winston-Salem is an exception. The rest of the country. He meant Boston. You know. But what I want to talk about tonight is what I've been through since that time, past 7 years, 8 years. And essentially, what I want to do is try to focus on the naivete and innocence of the school reform discussion up to now, and the way which so many of us have talked about public education. Essentially, we've been in the position of standing up in front of our principal or supervisor or school committee, whichever it was, and we took this childlike position. We'd say, look, principal or supervisor, I said, look, this system isn't working properly. It's not producing people like Malcolm X, St. Francis, Thoreau. It's producing you. And please, would you fix that for us? Or if we were a little more radical, we'd go up to the next higher level, the school committee. In our city, the school committee was run by, well, the school committee chairman was a chairwoman, Mrs. Hicks. And we'd go to her and we'd say, look, Mrs. Hicks, the school system isn't working. It isn't producing bold, courageous, liberated, sexual, healthy, passionate, risk-taking women like St. Joan. It's producing you. Please, would you fix that for us? If we were really political, far left, we would say, we'd go to the top, you know, and we'd, to Richard Nixon, and we would say, look, you, say, this school system isn't working. It isn't producing people like Tom Paine, Joe Hill, Tolstoy, Che Guevara. It's turning out cold, denatured, alienated, unloving murderers like you. Please, could we have a grant from Title III to fix that? Essentially, we turn to the very men who are the prime beneficiaries, engineers, and products of the unjust system which has held our kids in servitude forever, and we ask them please to issue us a license for the revolution. Well, isn't surprised that we do this. There's the classic story that comes out of the University of Buffalo from last year, 2 years ago. The radical student who rushed on campus as an SDS leader. He was he was very radical. He had a work shirt, brown work shirt, that's the best kind. And he had an afro. He was Jewish, an electric afro. And he was the political leader, and he rushed on, he pushed the professor off the platform. It's a Chaucer lecture. And the professor was right in the middle of the Miller's Tale. And what happened was, at universities like State University of New York in Buffalo, you get huge lectures, like 1,000 students. And the kid went to pieces when he realized that he had power over 1,000 students. It was scary to have that kind of power. I'm frightened every time it happens to me. And he was so scared. You see, what happened was instead of doing something, he didn't know what he wanted to do. You see, he just wanted to interrupt the lecture. And he turned to the professor and he said, "Excuse me, sir, we're trying to take over the university." He nearly cried. He said, "I'd like to interrupt your lecture if you don't mind." And the professor, who was an old member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, said, and the professor got mad. Not because the guy had interrupted his lecture, but because the guy was so gutless. And he threw him out. He pushed him off the platform, and he said, "You'll never pull it off if you have to ask your goddamn teacher for permission." It isn't astonishing that we learn this kind of lesson in the public schools. This is what they're for. For 12 years, we lift our hand and we ask our teacher for permission for everything. You know, the way in Boston, they always say, could I go down to the basement? Do they say that here? In modern schools, they don't have basements. So, I mean, to pee. Or to throw up. After 12 years, it isn't surprising that we also learn to ask the teacher for permission to go out and have a revolution. 9/10 of American liberalism is built upon this ritual of guaranteed defeat. Asking again what was refused before, but telling ourselves we are good people because we have at least had courage to instigate the ritual of asking. This is what I want to talk about tonight. It's the terrible innocence of people like myself, John Holt, Edgar Friedenberg, and Goodman, man I admire now. Gone from us. We essentially what we do is we stand here and we write these books of protest and we wait for our utopian notions to be put into application by people who despise us and people who don't agree with anything that we believe, who have no sense of justice. Nixon, Hicks, Rafferty, Hayakawa. We stand here and we say to them, you know, this is what we believe, act upon it. The fear of confrontation. were unwilling to admit that they are genuinely against us, and the things that we believe are things they cannot conceivably concede without denying their own power, their own courage, their own reality. The real weakness of the free school rebellion, the radical school rebellion in the United States, consists in our fear and hesitation to speak in honest terms about the actual function of the public schools. The real function of public schools in the United States is the one that we define in case of enemy nations, nations we dislike, as state indoctrination, control, brainwashing. When we talk about bad countries like Russia, China, we're very clear about what we mean. When I was a kid, they used to speak of Red China, but now they don't say that. They speak of the People's Republic of, how do they say that now? The People's Democratic Republic of China. When I was a little kid, when I was growing up, we had this image of 800 million little red ants. Now, President Nixon has gone there to visit them. It's different. Now it's 800 million cute little red ants. So they don't say that anymore. But the words are different in the schools of education in the United States, but the function is the same. So the same function, political indoctrination of children, blood loss, self-debilitation. The obvious example is the flag pledge. Do they have a flag here? Yes, there it is. That's the most obvious example. We tell children they're coming into school to talk about ethics, to discuss the justice, injustice of the nation they live in, and above their head is the flag, which symbolizes the nation to which they're forced to swear allegiance. Teachers who accept this, who do the pledge with their children every morning, are dishonest. I can't force them to disavow the ritual, but I can ask them please to think about its significance, about its meaning. Why did they do it? And what is the impact on the children upon whom this kind of dishonesty is imposed? But it's obvious, and it's a simple ritual. For those who are involved in struggle, it's not worth detailed discussion. Much more important, the kind of rituals which don't look political but are. So I'm going to switch gears somewhat and speak of areas that don't seem to be political. English classes, for example. And ask, what is the political bias of the English class? A classic ritual is something like this. Teachers in the public schools, in the elementary schools especially, are scared of the first person pronoun. They're scared of being asked to take a position in the first person. Let's say a child says something rude to you, insulting to you. I've had this happen many times. The teacher, instead of saying, I'm hurt by what you've said, tries to sidestep the attack. It says something like this. She says, is that any way to speak? This is what I wish you would say. I wish you would say, is that any way to speak to Miss O'Brien? See? Is that any way to speak to me? Me. Instead, she steps sideways. She says, is that any way to speak to Mr. Bryan? Or she puts herself in third person. And the question that exists for the children is, where is she? See, where is the teacher? It's as if she were not there. It's as if she wasn't present in the classroom. It's as though she were a third person hiding in the coat closet with the chalk and chalk erasers. Over at Harvard, you hear this in a more dramatic way. I don't want to make fun of the classroom teacher at the expense of the... I want to leave the university professors immune from criticism. At MIT and Harvard, you hear this kind of thing. A professor who's been working for 5-6 years on his thesis, and he's suddenly about to pour out his heart to the people in front of him, and he says, "One might well ask if it could be described. It seems at least within the bounds of reason to propose." One might suggest, it could, I think, be argued by some people. In each case, he's speaking in the third person. He's using an alienated verb form so that he can't be pinned down. It's a perfect syntax for an alienated nation. Have any of you ever been to Cambridge? No? Yes? Yes? Well, go to the faculty club sometime if you go to Cambridge, go to Harvard. You hear the professors talking, and there's this feeling that they don't exist as first persons, but they're talking about somebody else. Do you know what they serve as dessert at the faculty club? Lime sherbet. It's the dessert of alienated people. If they'd served a good Jewish dessert, they wouldn't have this problem. I used to go there with my father, who taught at the medical school at Harvard, and I would listen to the conversations, and I would jot down notes on what they said. And what would frighten me would be the degree to which the people at the faculty club could alienate themselves from history so that they didn't seem to have any role in it. And this is the kind of thing you would hear among especially the sociologists. If one were to look without remorse into a matter like the problems of the urban poor, begin with the subjunctive, you see. If one were to consider in all its solemn implications the viewpoint often expressed by any number of intelligent men in recent years, if one were to so hypothesize, if one were in fact come right out and say that these were grounds for serious reconsideration, for major reallocation, the policies of recent days, then it might well be time to look with favor on the search for new approaches and for parallel avenues of exploration. It might indeed be time to speak of ways in which to intervene and interrupt the course of tranquil speculation. The feeling you got was that you were listening to noodles. So it was a whole room full of third persons. The feeling was that nobody there was speaking as himself. This is from a high school lesson that I heard a few years ago when I was visiting in schools in New York State. Listen to this. Instructions for term papers. You will consult at least 15 separate sources, half of which are books, half periodicals. Take notes in 4x6 cards, not 3x5. It's important, you see. Take notes on 4x6 cards, not 3x5. Be prepared to present them upon demand. Bibliography and footnote will follow the MLA style sheet. At least 1,000 words with a cover sheet that includes a statement of purpose. The paper should have a clearly indicated beginning, middle, and end. Do not use the word I except in the end. You couldn't admit that you were there until you were about to leave the room. It's a huge lot of our education. A massive amount of our adult dialogue involves the same invalidation of our own reality. Not only the use of third person, but also the conditional, also the subjunctive. Subjunctive, as you all know, at Wake Forest is the verb form of hypothesis, as if. Conditional is the syntax of tangential possibilities. Third person is the pronoun of self-abdication. Together they constitute the ideal rhetoric of the man, a woman whose hands are skilled, but heart is dead. Conscience is in exile. Well, some of this may amuse you, some of you may be enraged. Be naive, however, for us to pretend that incidents and discussions of this sort were evidence of the failure of public education in the United States. Terms not of my purposes, but of yours, and of the assigned, accepted, unquestioned function of the public schools in the United States. These kinds of institutions are doing a good job. We do elect Nixon. We do not elect Thoreau. We do begin, maintain, and slavishly complete an evil war. We do maintain the side of the unjust in every corner of the earth, against the cause of the sick, the desperate, the poor. We are not in a state of revolution. We are in a state of ethical exhaustion, political surrender, glamorously decorated in the colors and the rock beats of a rich kid's counterculture. Harlem is unchanged. Roxbury is unchanged. Cleveland is unchanged. The south side of Chicago is unchanged. Brazil is unchanged. The Union of South Africa is unchanged. Guatemala is unchanged. The First National Bank of Boston is unchanged. The Reynolds Tobacco Company is unchanged. The U.S. State Department is unchanged. Spiro Agnew is unchanged. New Haven, Connecticut is unchanged. Lincoln and Lexington and Louisville and Phoenix and Scarsdale and Seattle are unchanged. Princeton is unchanged. The trees that line the beautiful homes on Brattle Street in Cambridge are unchanged. Harvard Law School is unchanged. Harlem Hospital is unchanged. Black infant death statistics in New Jersey are unchanged. David Rockefeller's townhouse on the east side of Manhattan is unchanged. Public education is working very well. It's doing a good job. To me, the most important tragedy is the degree to which young people who have once cared deeply about the things that I've talked about tonight are able to drift on from cause to cause and leave us behind, move on to their own self-concerned, self-interested occupations, leave us without allies, without comrades. I don't know how to rally people to our cause. I don't know any other way but to describe the pain we know and the desperation that we come from. Let me describe, this is, I hope none of you are taking notes on this lecture. If so, you're going to have a terrible set of notes. Let me describe an agony that I went through a couple of years ago. There's a kid I know in Boston who is brutalized by our school system in a way that probably happens here also in Winston-Salem, though nobody I've met here yet has been willing to admit that there's anything really wrong with Winston-Salem. There's a kid in Boston I know who's very hungry and very desperate and very poor. His name's Peter. He's 9 years old when I meet him. He weighs 60 pounds. I work with him. And I wonder why he's so light and why he has so little health. And I say to myself, well, it must be malnutrition. Years pass, we work with him from year to year, and he's 14. He still weighs 60 pounds, 70 pounds. Comes by my house at night, asks for supper. So, like any other white liberal, I cook something good for him. Spaghetti and hamburger, good lamb chops, something like that. And make him eat. Come on, I say, eat it up, Peter. A year or more, I keep on doing this kind of thing. He has trouble learning in public school, and I say to myself, well, he's just hungry in the mornings. A year comes, a year goes by. Suddenly I know deep in my heart that he's no longer growing. So I go into a panic. The world falls into pieces. A test made. It takes 6 months to get him into Children's Hospital in Boston. He's examined by a social worker, and the word I come up with is microcephalic. Brain growth was impeded prior to birth, or else when he was an infant, he'll never grow up to normal size. So I sit there with one of these doctors, Boston. I say, he's only a kid, he's little. Can you tell me this? And the doctor has the power of his expertise and knowledge, and he says, this young man will never grow up to normal size. I ask the doctor what causes this. He says, prenatal care. The mother is ill or poor or underfed. Sometimes there's no obstetric care. Often it's a case of near starvation. Poor people in the deep south, because most of the kids we know come from this part of the country, from the state, Georgia and South Carolina. And I listen, I hear, I think to myself, it fits in pretty well with what I know. And this doctor, this icy kind of doctor, he goes on, he says, with proper facilities and with the right health care, the proper programs. We deal with this when the mother first came in. Almost never happens in white neighborhoods anymore. See how reassuring that is. It's a problem of the ghetto slum and impacted sections in the cities. Someday, of course, we ought to have facilities to deal with this. And this is idiot's optimism, the way he talks. You see, someday. But we're alive on this day. This little boy, Peter, will not be born someday, will not be crippled one day. He's sitting here, right outside the doctor's office, this day. Peter's not a kid who might come in, perhaps, for an examination one day, and we might meet or think of, deal with someday, a statistician's future. He's alive right now. It'll be too late for him the next time. So I sit here with this doctor. He says to me, well, everything's getting better. Things are going to improve. In medical terms, things aren't getting better in the United States. Things are getting worse for poor children, for black children. The gap between black infant death and white infant death statistics has increased during the past 5 years. Since Nixon's come into power, it's become greater. This is a myth that people live by. Things get better, poor get richer. The lame will walk, sick will soon be healed. All those people who are sitting and waiting in poor people's hospitals around the land will soon be gone, cared for. Meanwhile, a powerful and important man can have his private room in the Mayo Clinic. Poor people can check into the slum hospitals in Winston-Salem or in Harlem or Chicago. This is the kind of cruelty we have to deal with. It's very difficult to raise this issue on a college campus in 1973 because most college kids have been effectively manipulated by the press and media to feel that the most important thing is to deal with their own needs and take care of their own requirements, their own pleasures. There's a common fashion now, which is widely advertised by the mass media, which is essentially we deal with our own discomfort, and those whom we do not see, we deal with later. Well, to me, to those of us I've worked with in Boston, this is unconscionable. We know so many people now who have moved on from one movement to another. They switch gears every 2 years because they can't bear the possibility of victory. I hear rich kids out in suburban neighborhoods near Boston, New York, they talk to me like this. Well, they ask me, what are you doing now? Because most of them have read my last book, Death at an Early Age, and they say, well, are you still working in the ghetto? And if I say yes, then this is the answer. They say, oh man, are you still in that race and ethics bag? Look, they say, Nixon's been elected. Times have changed. Why are you still doing that? And I say to them, well, it's because where I live. It's where I live, and these are the children that I know. And they say, well, why don't you move on to something new? Are you still in that same old bag? And how can I tell them that the children that I know don't live in a bag, but they live in the real world and that they're in pain? I often hear this kind of rap when I visit colleges. This is what college kids say. They say, well, you're in an old bag. That's that ethics bag. And we're in a new bag. We're into pollution. The rivers have replaced people. They say, well, we're into homemade bread. We're into communes. We're into, you know, that we always hear that phrase. I don't know why they say that. You know, wheat germ. We're into, you know, pottery kilns. Oh, we don't know. We don't care about pottery kilns. We don't care about wheat germ. We care about kids we know who are starving. We think that these people are deceiving themselves or being successfully deceived by the government. We don't understand this. They say, well, we're into rivers. We think clean rivers are very important, but we don't think clean rivers are very important. We do not care to see clean rivers flowing sweetly through a racist and divided nation. See, to us that doesn't matter. And they say, well, we're into wheat germ, we're into pot, we're into homemade bread, we're into women's lib. And each of these things might be of some worth, but the question for us isn't the value of each item, it's the value of our forward motion. To people who keep on going from one movement to the next. Instead of going from completion to completion, they go from one failure to the next. Each movement gets publicity, produces literature, discussion, controversy, talk shows, a special issue of Time, Life, or Saturday Review, new thing to be into. Nobody who is now in pain will be in less pain when it's all over. I've met some people this afternoon who cared a lot about the reclamation of the land in Kentucky and the strip mining that goes on there, but that's a different issue because those are people who care about people. They're not just talking about the land. This is the kind of cruelty I hear. Listen, I hear this in the high schools around Boston, New York, Chicago. We talk about blacks who are starving and hungry and desperate. That's what we hear. Kids stand up and they say, we used to be into that race and conscience bit. Have you heard that phrase? Bit. We're into a new bag now. That's what these kids say. And we think the kids we know, you know, it's real kids who are hungry. We wonder, how can people walk out on that? How can they just drift off and say, well, that's old-fashioned. That's Martin Luther King, but we shot him successfully, so now we can quit and walk out. I know a doctor in Boston, a psychiatrist, and somebody asked him last year, why is it all the young radical doctors that you knew, that you were close to, have quit the struggle for health care among poor people? Why is it that they've all moved off to farms and communes in Vermont? The doctor said, well, his name was Jackie Walls, he said, well, I guess they were beginning to be scared. I guess they were afraid that if they stuck to anything longer than 12 months, they might succeed. We think this is a problem among college kids in the United States. They've gone from movement to movement, thing to thing. Each one of the things they do may be a good thing in itself. Moving on isn't a good thing if it means that you're betraying people. So I'm standing here tonight with you, and we're faced with this dilemma. People who have been well indoctrinated by the media, by the stuff they read, by the things they see on television, by the things their teachers tell them at the university, to move on and deal with their own causes. And we know people who are starving and who are desperate, who are hungry, who are sick and don't have doctors, who are desperate and don't have food, who have rats in their apartments, don't have landlords who will deal with it, who will come and deal with their problems. And we see college kids all over the country drifting off to communes to deal with their own problems, to address themselves to their own needs. They don't care about the people that we know. Makes us angry. Well, everyone who likes Nixon has left by now. We've lost about 25 people tonight. And when I came down south, down here from Boston 4 or 5 years ago, I found that everybody was inspired because Martin Luther King was still alive, but now he's dead. You don't have to fight for him anymore because you don't have to deal with him because he can't appear in your midst. So you can just, you know, advocate justice, but lead your own traditional, selfish, rotten lives that you've always lived in Winston-Salem. Serving the needs of Reynolds Tobacco Company and all the other companies that dominate the life and economics of the city. But we're still friends, Amy and I. We still live amongst poor black people in Boston, and their lives began down here. They came from here to our city. And many of them are brain damaged. And why are they brain damaged? Because they were born in your rotten hospitals. Why are they sick? Because they were born in your hospitals. And why don't they know how to read? Because they went to your schools. And they come north to Boston looking for better jobs, but they don't get better jobs because our city is just as rotten as your city. And our university is just as selfish as this college right here. And what are you going to do about it, you kids living here and going through this college?